Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
We're back with the sad case of muzzling climate scientists in Canada with journalist Margaret Munro, recorded at the 2012 conference of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science. After Margaret, we'll get an update on scientific freedom, or lack of it, in the United States. Here's Ms. Munro.
One of the cases involved this fellow, Dr. Scott Dalimore. He works in Victoria. But here he is standing in front of melting permafrost up in the Beaufort Sea in the Arctic. Now, he works for the Geological Survey of Canada. He's a gifted communicator. Scott has done dozens of medias with international, national media over the years. And he was the guy that you could phone him up, and he was sort of authorized to talk to the media almost. You know, he could answer your questions. And he didn't get into politics. He would stick to the science. But he was a very accessible guy, like many senior scientists in the government were. But that all changed for Scott and his department, actually, in April 2010, when Scott Dalimore and his colleagues published this study in the journal Nature. It's about a flood in Canada's north that happened 13,000 years ago. There's nothing controversial about this study, but Dalimore was told he couldn't speak to reporters without permission from Ottawa. And as government documents later showed, Dr. Dalimore needed to get permission from his political minister's office in Ottawa. And he didn't get the minister's permission in time to do interviews on the flood study. And when this got out, it generated a lot of controversy. People called it Orwellian, and with all kinds of editorials. Here you have the Vancouver Sun said it offended the principle of public service. The Saskatoon Star Phoenix said, when you have to assess the implications for the minister of a flood that happened 13,000 years ago, you know that government information control has gone too far. And then last year, there was an even more bizarre case involving this woman, Dr. Christine Miller. She's a federal fishery scientist. And she led a study that was published in the journal Science on sockeye salmon. That's these guys. There's a lot of concern about these fish. They're a very famed and valuable fish here on the West Coast. And a lot of them, like huge numbers of them, are some years do not make it to the spawning grounds. So her study that was published in Science, it suggested that viral infections might explain why so many of these fish were dying before they had a chance to spawn. And the study was published January 14th, 2011. And 5 days before that, the Science's media office in Washington, it highlighted her study in their press pack that goes to thousands of reporters around the world. And this gives reporters several days to prepare the story before the embargoes lift on the study. So there was plenty of interest in this. Lots of journalists phoned up asking for interviews. There was people from Time, Wired, the Globe and Mail, CBC, lots of others. And they were all told by the media office at the Department of Fisheries here in Vancouver that Dr. Miller would be available, that they were going to arrange interviews, but we just have to wait a bit, but there would be interviews. But the days ticked by, and the reporters' deadlines came and went, and Dr. Miller, we never heard from her. She was not available to give interviews. And it was so strange, particularly because the government had said she'd be available. I thought, what is going on? So I filed an access to information request asking for the documents relating to her study. And 6 months later, almost 800 pages of documents were released. 800 pages were released in response to the ATI request. They gave a glimpse of this elaborate approval, or in the case of Dr. Miller, a disapproval process that she had to go through. The documents show how she'd wanted to talk to the media about her study, but she needed several layers of approval in Ottawa. First from the media office at the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, then the Deputy Minister's Office at Fisheries and Oceans, then from the Fisheries Minister's Office, and then it had to go over to the Privy Council Office, which is an arm of the Prime Minister's Office. It would be sort of like asking the White House if you can talk about a fish study. So the documents show that she got approval all the way up to her fisheries minister's office. But it was when it landed over at the Privy Council office that all of a sudden the brakes went on and said, no, you cannot do the interview. And they also nixed a press release, and it said the study was too focused on dying salmon. So here we have a situation where the government knew weeks in advance that this study was coming out. And they could not get their act together to know whether or not she was going to be able to do interviews, to have a press release or anything. And the reporters were just so frustrated. This is a note that went, there's several notes that went back and forth between Greg Rasmussen, who's a national CBC reporter, and Diane Lake, who's the PR officer here in Vancouver for DFO. And as you can see at the bottom, he's like, what's happening to this interview? And it went on for 3 days, if you go all the way to the bottom. And at the end, on the 13th, which is the day the embargo lifts on the study, he says, you know, what is going on over there, right? What's the problem at your end? Like, I need to do this interview in like the next few minutes. At any rate, he never got the interview, and neither did anyone else. So when the story broke last summer on who had actually muzzled her, it was pretty big news out here in Vancouver, and it caught controversy, more editorials, you know, saying that here you have the treatment of one of the leading fisheries biologists reflects a worrisome disregard for the importance of neutral scientific facts, unfettered by political spin. And that was from the Ottawa Citizen. Then we had another case just last fall involving Environment Canada scientists who were co-authors. There's several Canadian co-authors on this paper about last year's unprecedented ozone hole up in the Arctic. Dr. David Tarasak works for Environment Canada, and he and his colleagues launched these are ozone sondes, but they basically carry instruments up several kilometers up into the atmosphere, and they can monitor how the chemicals are changing in the atmosphere. So we wanted to do a story on this study, and we wanted to talk to the Canadian authors. So I sent an email I phoned Dr. Tarasak. He said, I would talk to you, but you need to talk to the media office first. So I sent the little note off to the media office with the questions, according to their rules, and, you know, I sort of waited. And as you can see from this email here, I'd asked on the 27th for interviews, and I submitted my questions. They waited till the 29th to get back to me saying, thanks for your inquiry. While the interview cannot be granted, we can give you this response. And they give us all this blue stuff here. This is a comment that we can attribute to Dr. Tarasak. So they never explain why there was no interview. You just can't do the interview. And this is pretty normal practice for the federal government, and particularly for Environment Canada. So again, we just pointed this out in our story. And again, more headlines, more people decrying what was going on. And it came up in Parliament that the Environment Minister, Peter Kent, got really questioned on the muzzling of the scientists. It got pretty heated over this issue. But the government just stuck it out, as they say. But then, in a weird twist in this one, a few weeks later, Environment Canada phoned the media office and said, you can speak to Dr. Tarasak now. Like, the story has come and gone, right? But it's like, you can speak to Dr. Tarasak now. I wasn't available to do it, but one of my colleagues in Ottawa, Mike D'Souza, he did an interview with him. And again, he had to submit his questions in writing. But when he was getting to the end, he asked him, so why couldn't you talk about the study when the study actually came out? He said, I'm available when media relations says I'm available, and I have to go through them. Now, I know this is very frustrating. Oh, and again, more editorials about the whole thing. So this is frustrating for the scientists, and it's incredibly frustrating for journalists. And I know several reporters who, you know, they just don't even bother approaching the federal government anymore to talk to scientists because you end up very frustrated. So what has and can be done about this? Well, science writers and journalists, like, this is not just common to science journalists, and this happens to, like, a lot of political reporters are getting nowhere in Ottawa as well. So there's been a lot of public discussion about this, and there's been letters, and there was an open letter sent by the Canadian science writers to the political leaders last year asking to restore access to the scientists. But the government, for the most part, won't really admit there's a problem. They maintain that there is timely, orderly access to scientists, which I disagree with. There's been a lot of controversy, and I do think it's helping. I think there's this pushback has actually got the government to the point where sometimes you can interview scientists. Like, you phone up and every once in a while it's so surprising that they actually can talk to you. But it's very hit and miss, and there doesn't seem to be much rhyme or reason to when they do it. And they're in charge, and it's very opaque what the policy is here. As I say, I think it's very important to document these examples, so I would encourage any and all journalists to document it and help us, you know, sort of try to restore access, because I really believe that science journalism, or just journalism, depends, just like science does, on the free flow of information. And I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Margaret Munro.
That was Margaret Munro, science reporter for the Canadian newspaper chain Post Media. Recordings from this session are courtesy of AVEN, the audio-visual education network, at aven.com. The printed program for this session lists a third panelist representing the Canadian government, namely Claire Dansereau, the Deputy Minister for the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. She didn't show up. The AAAS left an empty chair, symbolic of this government's unwillingness to speak or to face its critics. Obviously, the government agreed to come, but failed to show up, and that about says it all. Here is another crazy example. The supposedly neutral government called opponents of the proposed Enbridge Northern Pipeline unpatriotic, foreign-funded radicals. These radicals include pretty well every Aboriginal nation along the route from the tar sands and a majority of the Canadian public opposed to the pipeline. To make sure no one talks too much at the environmental impact hearings, the government imposed Orwellian rules. In procedural directive number 4, the panel ruled oral evidence should not include the following: technical or scientific information, opinions, views, information, or perspectives of others, detailed information on the presenter's views on the decisions of the panel, recommendations whether to approve or not to approve the project, or conditions that should be applied if the project were to proceed, or questions that the presenter wants answered. Presenter and federal member of Parliament Nathan Cullen, whose riding is most impacted by the would-be tar sands pipeline, was repeatedly interrupted and silenced by these rules of procedure. And by the way, most people only get 5 minutes to talk, no matter who they are. In other words, just shut up. Maybe you can talk about the weather. No science, no facts, no questions allowed. Is it any better for the American government-funded scientists now that Barack Obama has replaced oil man George Bush? Dr. Francesca Griffo reports to the AAAS conference.
Anyway, good morning and thank you. You know, it's just so strange because as I sat here listening to the previous talk, I thought, are we talking about the United States and Canada or are we talking about some other crazy part of the world? I mean, it just doesn't seem like this should really be how it is here. But sadly, it is. So basically, what I wanted to do this morning was tell you very quickly a little bit about the situation that we found ourselves in the previous administration in the U.S., and then talk a little bit about the work that we've done to try and get ourselves out of that situation. And hopefully, although our governments are very different, you know, we do have this democracy thing in common, and hopefully you might gain some insights from that and, you know, help you along your journey to try and stop this. So I think, as was alluded to before, both democracy and science are very much based on the free flow of information. Part of what we expect from our governments in a democracy is accountability, and that accountability really comes from transparency. And that's what this is about at its core. This isn't about some abstract right that scientists get to chatter about anything they want. This is about important information that has critical repercussions for our health, our safety, our environment, our world, our future, our children's future, and the ability to get that information out there so that we as citizens can really begin to evaluate and be a part of the decision-making process. So that's kind of why this is important. We began our work on this topic a number of years ago in the Bush administration. My apologies to chemists in the audience. But we took a little bit of license with the periodic table of the elements. And if you were to go to our website and click on each one of these elements, you would get to a one-page summary of, you know, an incident of political interference in science with primary documents. One of my personal favorites is when we caught up one of our higher-ups, political appointees in the Department of Interior, making track changes in a Word document, which she left in the track changes, changing the science so that we would have a different decision on endangered species. So that's the sort of thing that's in there. Now, these examples for us really spanned very, very diverse issues. Beryllium, you know, pharmaceuticals, formaldehyde and plywood. I mean, you name it. If it was inconvenient for either the government or a donor to our previous government, they suppressed it or manipulated it. One very quick example, the lunchboxes, vinyl lunchboxes. One of the cheap ways to make that vinyl is to put lead in the vinyl. In our Consumer Product Safety Commission, they were doing tests on the vinyl. They got very high levels of lead. When they swiped, a supervisor came in and said to the scientist who was doing it, he said, "Oh, my God, these levels are off the charts." And the scientist, the supervisor said, "Well, what happens when you keep swiping?" And the scientist said, "Well, the levels go down." He said, "Good. Keep doing that until you get an average that's within the legal limit." So that's the sort of thing that was going on. That's the lunchbox my kid was licking yogurt off the side of, right? Okay, and yours, perhaps. So many, many different examples. And in fact, one of the things that we did was to really, now our work focuses on, because we've made some progress across the federal agencies, which I'll talk about, we're now focusing on the drivers of that political interference. And it really is, you know, the corporate interference is huge for us in the U.S. And this is actually the cover of a report that we released today, and there are executive summaries over there. So the major flagship example, if you will, of this was, of course, Dr. Hansen, Goddard Space Institute, a part of NASA, who wanted to speak out about climate scientists and was muzzled. Now, the silly thing was that he turned out to be muzzled by a public affairs official who didn't even, it turned out, have a college degree. He'd lied on his resume. So anyway, but the point is, this was caused a very, very big kerfluffle and really began the conversation about this. And I will say that in response, even in the last administration, NASA did make some changes. But what we wanted to do was go out beyond this sort of an example to really look at this not as an anecdote, but as a trend. So what we began to do were actually surveys of scientists and federal agencies. And over the years, we surveyed some, 15,000 scientists across five agencies. And what we found was this. This is very typical. Actually, we surveyed many more than this. 42% of the respondents that we had said they feared retaliations for speaking out about their agency's mission-driven work. And this was not only outside the agencies with the media, but this was also inside the agencies where the decisions were being made. So this was pretty awful. And we have a number of surveys of different agencies that we've done. EPA, our Environmental Protection Agency, our Food and Drug Administration, our U.S. Department of Agriculture, climate scientists, Fish and Wildlife Service scientists, so many, many different agencies that we looked at. And we found very similar results across those agencies. We then thought, okay, let's try to look at this in a little bit more depth. So we did another investigation where we looked at 15 federal regulatory and science agencies, and we examined their existing media policies, some of which we couldn't find. We have something similar to your, we call it our Freedom of Information Act request, where you can ask for these policies. And then we looked at, through interviews and, again, more surveys, the implementation of those policies. And what we found was not actually a very pretty picture. We did a scorecard. One of the things that we do is try to bring visibility to this issue, and this scorecard was quite successful. So on the left, you see the name of the agency, then you see what they got as a grade on the policy, and then in the right column, how that policy was actually being implemented. You see a lot of red. It wasn't good. And what we found was that very few agencies had decent policies. A few agencies had decent policies that weren't being fully implemented. And a couple of agencies actually had a pretty decent culture without having a policy, just simply because of the way that those agencies were run. And because if you look, the agencies that did have a pretty good set of policies were those agencies that were pretty much purely scientific. Where you get the problems are where you have the science and the regulatory piece together in the same agency. As long as you have our U.S. Geological Survey, they don't have regulatory powers. They were being pretty much left alone. But of course, theoretically, this began to change when President Obama came to power. I guess he sort of has power, but came into office at any rate. Back in 2009, he promised immediately in his inauguration speech that he was going to restore science to its rightful place. We've spent a lot of time wondering what that actually means. But I think on the up and up, the trajectory is good. They are really moving in the right direction, and we're quite happy about that. It's taken a little while. It was 2010 before our science advisor, Dr. John Holdren, very well-known climate scientist, actually came out with these guidelines for how to put together these scientific integrity policies for each of the agencies. Those policies have a number of different parts to them. We found as we briefed agencies and met with agencies across the federal government, we worked with between 15 and 20 agencies, that in fact they were quite confused as to what this meant and how it could work. So one of the first things we did was actually pull together this document, which all of this is on our website. What we found was that piecemeal, here and there across the government, different agencies had little bits of it right. So we took that and pulled it together into this one document so that it was already written in federalese, and it made them much more confident in their ability to adapt it. The fact that Fish and Wildlife is actually doing that. We can do it too. So this document, I think, was quite helpful as they went through and actually formulated these policies. Basically, what we're looking for and what we asked for in a public communications policy were these things. Personal views exception. This is what you were referring to earlier, which is, I still have First Amendment rights even though I work for the federal government, essentially. So you can speak about research results as a scientist representing your agency. But we get the fact that you cannot have every scientist across the federal government making policy. This is a really difficult thing to do. It would just be crazy. But what you can have is every scientist across the federal government taking off their scientist cap, putting it aside, putting on their citizen cap and saying, this is what I think these results mean. This is what I think we should do about this problem. And that's what we're asking for here. The second piece is the right of last review. What we also found, and I haven't heard this quite yet in Canada, is that a lot of documents would take the scientific research, rewrite it. It would come out in some other form bearing very little resemblance to the original scientific research results. So this is right of last review, so that before something like that is released to the public, if it's based substantively on the work of a scientist, that scientist gets to review it and make sure that it's still scientifically accurate. The third one, defined roles for public affairs officers and scientists. These folks are gatekeepers. Facilitators, not gatekeepers. In other words, they don't get to say yes or no to the interview, but they can be a partner. They can have a very important role at promoting the scientist, promoting the research results and so on, helping to write press releases. God knows, as scientists, we can use all the help we can get sometimes writing for other audiences. So we're not saying they don't have an important role, but it isn't a gatekeeper role by any means. And scientists, as a professional courtesy, should let them know when they do an interview. I mean, that's just the polite thing to do and a professional thing to do. Non-disclosure agreements, what we also found were many scientists were being asked to sign these, which said that they could not disclose information about anything they were doing. And we also think that this is an ongoing process. You need to have ongoing training for public affairs officers and scientists so they know what they're doing or not doing. So that's what we were calling for in our request for this. One of the ways that we did this was we had several of the agencies said, okay, we're going to put our draft policies out for public comment. We're very fortunate at the Union of Concerned Scientists. We have very large networks of activists and scientists who work with us. Maybe some of you are in the room. But we asked them to weigh in and comment on these. So the first time we did that with the Department of Interior Policy, we had 3,000 comments. When we did it for the Environmental Protection Agency, we had 24,000 comments. And when we did it for NOAA, we had over 17,000 from activists and 165 unique comments. So this had a big impression on the agencies. My friend, who was a colleague working inside Interior, they did put out their draft policy. It was terrible. He called me the next day and he said, well, nothing like 3,000 comments to get the minister's attention or the minister equivalent. So it does have a way of focusing the mind in a way. Okay, so the current status. So what's going on now with these scientific integrity policies? Basically, we have a handful of agencies that have released policies. Department of Interior, USDA, EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, NASA, and of course NOAA has released theirs. What we found, though, was that really, out of all of those agencies, NOAA and the National Science Foundation are the two that have really tread new ground in media policies. They've really gone far beyond what we were asking for and actually in creating a policy that would do that. So that's quite wonderful. The other thing is that we've had to stay on our, I think, sort of maybe the equivalent of Privy Council in our Office of Science and Technology Policy and our Office of Management and Budget, these offices within the White House. We've really had to stay on top of them to keep this moving. And in fact, 2 weeks ago, I phoned and asked about the status and really said, gosh, guys, I really need to know what's happening next because I'm going to be talking at AAAS. And sure enough, 2 days ago, they came out with a blog post, which announced, or actually yesterday, that final or near final policies must be made public by March 30th. So they're coming. We're getting them very quickly. The NOAA policy, very quickly, is really one of the best. I think it's due to the leadership of Dr. Jane Lubchenco. It's really good to have a great scientist at the top of an agency thinking about these issues. But essentially, it encourages scientists to publish data and findings. NOAA will offer knowledgeable spokespersons if a reporter doesn't know who they need to call. But if a reporter knows who they need to call, then scientists may freely speak to the media and the public about the technical material that's based on their work. And if they want to express a personal opinion, they may do that by taking that personal views exception and disclaimer. We have gone on and continue to survey federal scientists, and again, what we're finding now in our most recent survey of the FDA is that, in fact, there is still an enormous amount of confusion. Scientists are not sure how this works and what they need to be doing. So clearly, the major challenge left to us is implementation. So to summarize very quickly how we got to this point, which is, I think, a really good place to be. We're moving in the right direction, by exposing and bringing visibility to the examples. Document, document, document. Very important. We connected the censorship to the impacts on people's lives. This isn't an abstract issue. This is an issue that matters to people. We used congressional hearings to make agency heads accountable, in fact, very nervous. We made scientific integrity an election issue, an election issue, and we've kept the pressure on to really make these policies continue. So as I said, the current challenge is implementation. This is a huge task that we have ahead of us. And in fact, I'll be doing a symposium talk on Sunday at 8 a.m. specifically on this implementation piece and what that looks like. And we will have the folks in charge of this at a couple of our federal agencies there speaking. So I think that will be very interesting. Thank you.
That was Dr. Francesca Griffo from the Union of Concerned Scientists speaking at the 2012 meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science on February 17th, as recorded by AVN.com. At least scientists funded by the American government have a right to speak, something the Canadian government needs to learn. But plenty of pressure remains to keep the U.S. scientists quiet or minimize the risks, even as the climate tips us towards oblivion. As Griffo told the audience, it's still all about the money.
But I think there's one other elephant in the room that it's hard to not talk about, which is the enormous amounts of money that flow to campaigns, to elected officials, you know, at least in the U.S. I'm not speaking for Canada, but and that has a huge influence. I mean, we know, we've seen this with multiple decisions that were going to have profound impacts on one sector of industry, that in fact that sector was heavily lobbying the White House, meeting with them over and over again, meeting with the heads of agencies. In particular, when we went to regulate ozone, you know, we know that they were meeting with Lisa Jackson, the head of our Environmental Protection Agency. She stood strong, which is the good news. But then, in fact, the White House put off the decision because of the enormous pressure. And it's about money.
Get the Union of Concerned Scientists report, How Corporations Corrupt Science at the Public's Expense, from UCSUSA.org, UCSUSA.org, or find this and other links in my blog at ecoshock.info. Canadian climate scientist Andrew Weaver got a laugh as he explained why right-wing claims about a solid conspiracy by scientists around the world to push their agenda is so ludicrous.
No, that's a really good question. The problem there is scientists are by and large, a disorganized bunch of yahoos at lab benches.
No worse than journalists.
Yeah, who don't. But our organizations are typically not run. I mean, we have national organizations, and you have meteorological organizations in Canada and the U.S., but there, again, there's a fear of retribution at the organizational level, because these organizations often have charitable status. It doesn't seem to stop the Heartland Institute in the U.S., I seem, but it does it in Canada. They have
they get branded radicals.
They could have their taxable status challenge. So they typically are cautious. And as an individual scientist, never have been organized. I mean, the fact that there's an element of society that believes somehow there's a conspiracy of a cabal of scientists concocting a global warming problem is just bizarre. If anyone knows, you couldn't get half a dozen scientists in a room to agree that the sky is blue, let alone that global warming is an issue. So it's because we naturally don't organize. We naturally fight amongst ourselves. It's the nature of science, is to challenge, to fight, to be difficult. It's not to organize and provide a united front.
But do you have a sense that your colleagues in the government are frustrated with?
Oh, absolutely. More than frustrated. It's like last one out, turn out the lights.
So that is why North Americans and some people down under don't believe we are facing climate disaster, even as the Arctic melts and crazy weather drowns or dries out the world. Big business and rich fanatics use charitable donations to create doubt in our minds. The same powers that be buy off government officials or threaten countries with economic ruin if scientists explain our peril and what we need to do to avoid a calamity. We like to believe the candy-coated lies, accept the propaganda, and get used to the silencing of truth. That's how it is on a faraway planet somewhere in the Milky Way. Reporting from planet Earth, this is Alex Smith. Visit our website at ecoshock.org, and thank you for listening. We'll let George Michael say what needs to be said. Freedom. Freedom.